what I was saying is that, so I'm going to start from an example of what we say. Part of my discussion, although it's the topic, it's in some ways taking things from a different direction than some of the things we've discussed so far, but I'm hoping to show you that it actually relates quite closely. And so the first thing I'd like to ask people to do as an exercise is just think of someone you consider wise, and then, or you know, maybe perhaps wise in one moment or approaching wisdom, and then and just mark down so who that would be and on what you know what it is about them that you know just a couple of words of that sort. I mean, you're also free to say I can't think of anybody. That question doesn't work for me, or you know, something of that kind.
Someone living.
Yeah, it can be somebody you know, ideally, or
yes.
And also, I'm going to add a further constraint to this and say, if your native language is other than English, please write it in that language. You know, so I know, for example, Michelle, if you were to write in French, or say,
Croatian,
exactly. It's a different language, so that we can just get a sense of. First of all, it'll be much easier to write anyhow, but. I'm just curious what kinds of accounts people will come up with. So that'll be number one. And then number two will be, in your own life, can you think of some moment that that you consider that you've been wise? And so what happened?
Can you repeat
slowly the okay. two points? Are we going to have to reveal these?
Not necessarily. I mean, so basically, I was thinking to use a similar approach to Russ to say, we can even use his numbers, but I'll pick a number at random, and then you can feel free to say, I don't want to talk about it, or you can say, here's my example. So the instruction is someone you consider wise, that you're massage, that you know, and also in your life, Romada, it's a something like that, where you thought you were wise.
A moment.
It could be a whole period of life. I don't know how you want to define it. It could be one, say, you know, one event. It could be, And the question, and the further thing was just to write it in your own language.
To write what? Just how it was, or
some things enough that you could actually remember it. You know, of course, if you were to write the whole thing, maybe it would take you a while, but you might have a couple of, you know, sort of words that you just that would help you remember if we were to call on you. Similar to the experience sampling that we've done before. Okay, so is that a good amount of time for people? Or I see a few people still writing. So. Okay. Well, let's just go ahead and really, as I said, if you're asked about it, that you can. Say something, and basically what I'm going to talk about is a project that I'm involved in, which is going to be, in essence, asking these questions to people around the world, and then at different ages. And so maybe I thought I would give a bit of backdrop to this and connect it to this conference, and one obvious way to connect it is, I'm sure. For many people, you know, Chalmers, say,
is making the same point that's been made here. But he, in 2004, he wrote that, you know, as important as it is to have a first-person science, there are at least three obstacles that we can imagine for it. One is the privacy. Well, some people have addressed whether things are completely private. But we have somewhat primitive methodologies for assessing first-person science, and also primitive formalisms for describing it. So, and I think that's some of the things that are going to come up here as well. And
Susan, can you put this on the screen?
Oh, sure, okay. If people are interested, I mean, I can easily just put it.
I don't know if you didn't intend to.
No, I can do that. I mean, I was, that was my original flight. Yeah, I think I might need will this work with a Mac, or do I need my own little...
You need a little computer.
Yeah, I've got it here, actually. Actually, I can't find that adapter for some reason, although I usually have it. So.
I don't think they're the same as the other Mac. That's a Mac, right? But it's a Pro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you might not.
In my mind, but sometimes
now
they're
I
very
don't
different.
Yeah.
Oh, it has to be that one?
Yeah, I think so.
No,
I
didn't
read it. Check more carefully. I've tried this thing around with me for so many times.
Is it essential to
you? No, not really. That's why I originally...
Why don't you just bear with it? I mean, I'm worrying.
No, it's completely different.
Yeah.
I think it would be, but
it's big.
Yeah, no, so that's the thing. I mean, basically this is, you know, what I'm saying is pretty much what would appear on the screen. And so in that sense, it's not as interesting as if you're seeing a movie or something of that kind. And that's why I was not as, say, concerned about it.
And you could, if you haven't, you could post this on the
website. And of course I can post this. So actually for things that are quotes of different kinds, I'm glad to post that on the website, and so you can have access to it then. So basically I'm actually going to skim over some of the other reason why I wasn't going to necessarily broadcast this is that there are parts of what I was going to say that have been said, say, better and more fully by other people, and so I'm just going to skip over those bits. And then one of them is, say, this idea that starting from the first person as the basis for your science. So you know, that's exactly what Michelle was saying earlier, what Max has said, what many people have said, actually, that there's really, you can make the point that yeah, that was our agreement, so
okay.
Let's go ahead.
Yeah.
No, well, anyways, I think I was just getting started, but on the other hand, I think it would be interesting to... Okay. To give you a chance also.
Then this is the, and we agree that I'm going to give you an interview, so we can use the same numbers as we have before. Everybody remember what the number is?
Yeah.
Okay, here's the number.
7.
So at the moment of the beep, what was going on with you?
At the moment of the beep, I was looking at this one. It's a very, very sick thing. There is no transition. This was a plain and full attention to what he was saying, and also to. I was also thinking of him, of the impression I had of him, and a little bit blushing, I saying, and I thought he looks very committed and sincere, and things like that. This was what I was thinking.
Okay, and so are you saying that you were both looking at him and also somehow thinking he looks sincere? And
yeah.
And is that a thought process or an emotional process or both or neither one, or how does that go?
Yes, an emotional process.
And I guess I used the term process, which was probably a mistake. But so I'm really interested in the experience. Was this an emotional experience or a thinking experience? Or both or neither?
I think it was rather an emotional experience because it was not very formulated like that. It was just the attention which was sustained by this feeling.
Okay. And is this feeling, is there more to say about this feeling? Was it in your head, in your body, either one, both?
It goes, well, every other around the head.
And when you say around the head, you also go down like to the neck and the, yeah. Is that intentional? So that it,
and larger than
larger than your head.
Yes.
And
you can move around the head.
So outside the head, not inside the head, but actually your experience is somehow outside of your body. Is that what you're saying? And
that's very much like that. Just around.
Just like that. in this direct vicinity. Yeah. And is that true when you say you get down to your neck and your chest? It's just outside here as opposed to inside. So is this an outer? Is this experience outside of your body entirely, or is it inside as well?
No, it's inside, but a little bit sort of extension, a little extension around.
And when you say inside your head, do you mean inside your entire head, or in the front of your head, or
the whole
volume of your cranium, so to speak, plus a little bit out in front? Is that what you mean? So I guess what I'm trying to get at is you could be saying, well, it's inside my head, but just sort of in the front half of my head, or it's inside my head, sort of throughout my head, and either one's okay with me. I have a
just the conversation, because I seem to experience very much of the space behind and from just experiencing this sort of heat of
is heat
slight heat of the sympathy, thinking of what you were saying.
And you're seeing him at the same time, in the sense that your eyes are aimed at him, or in the sense that you're actually in before the footlights of your consciousness, paying some kind of attention to him. But it's possible for your eyes to be aimed, but not be registering the experience.
I was really looking at him and seeing him and paying attention to what he was saying. And at the same time, this background experience of sympathy.
Mm-hmm. And when you say background experience, do you mean that that's of sort of less salience to you than looking at him? Or equal or more so? So I'm trying to figure out what you meant by background.
It's difficult to separate the attention from the
human. And anything else going on in your experience at this moment?
Just also the colors that you wear around. It's a very compound experience with also sensorial, the colors.
And were those colors, and by the colors, do you mean the colors of the video or the colors of the picture?
The video is the view of the video, which was.
Yeah. And are those in your? I'm understanding that those are in your retina. There's no question about that they're in your retina. But whether they were in your experience is another question. And I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just trying to make sure I understand what you're talking about. So are you in some way paying attention to the blueness of the screen at the same time as you're paying attention to Michelle?
Mm-hmm.
Or
it's just didn't really pay attention to the food, but just seeing Michel as detaching from the food.
Anybody else want to ask questions about this?
Then when you say you were observing his commitment and his sincerity.
Yeah.
What were you actually observing? Was either the expression of his face or something from his body? Or
the expression of his face.
I'd add if you know to that question.
If you know, okay.
Because it's not necessary that it can
be. That's true. Can you say something about what aspect of the expression on his face was? Was it his mouth, or his eyes, or
probably his eyes? Yes.
But you say probably, so maybe you're not sure.
No, well, maybe I'm mixing up also other think that they spend a little bit earlier, a few minutes.
So this may have been.
I think it was, maybe this experience was, I think we described that by saying that the previous experience was a little bit fading. The experience of detailed observation of Michel was a little bit fading, and rather the pure impression of sincerity was still there, even though the criteria were not there any longer. I was just more paying attention to the content of what he was saying. But on this background.
So let me observe here that Michel has. It is in the last paragraph here using a lot of what I would call subjunctifiers, in the sense of saying maybe, I think, I'm not sure, could be, that kind of thing, now peppers his description, which wasn't there before. And to me, that is evidence that we've moved beyond what he's really capable of describing about what's going on at the moment of the week. And that could be because your question led him in a direction that he wasn't ready to go. There isn't any real formula for how to know what's a good question and what's a bad question, but if you ask a question and you get subjunctifiers, that was probably a bad question.
Mm-hmm.
And his answers, I think, should be greeted with somewhat more skepticism, because he's peppering it with skepticism himself. He's saying, well, it could be, I'm not sure, maybe a little uncomfortable about the question.
Mm-hmm.
But, in the last words of Michel, he said, I saw something new that he hadn't said before, that he was listening to Michel, because you didn't mention that.
I was paying attention to what you say, but with the background of this feeling, the expression, and somehow my attention was enhanced by this impression.
I thought he said listening as a maybe his first word about it, but then moved on to looking at it. So I did not follow along on that track. Maybe I should have. I don't think actually that my method, this method, gets a totally complete picture ever. And so it could very well be that I have overlooked a thread that I should have gone across. And it's also the case that the longer you talk about something, the weaker the signal is by comparison to the noise. So I would say that we have probably looked this deep for what we can get out of it at this particular moment, and we ought to turn it back to Michel, and if you can rewind a little bit, I'll turn the beeper off and bring us back on board, and thank you very much for that.
Okay. Well, thanks. So actually, it's something of a natural transition point, luckily, or at least I'll make it into one, and say, I read a very interesting interview with Maturana. It was published in 2004. And in the context of it's a long conversation, actually several conversations that were given, he makes this observation that mistakes are not faults. They're not failures of our capacities. They don't show our limitations. Rather, they arise as reflections on the course of our doings. And I guess the claim I'm wanting to make, which people can dispute, is the same is going to be true of wisdom. Meaning that, you know, we'll come later to what somebody might have written as an example, but I think similar to something like a mistake, it's got to be something that's a reflection about the course of your life, or your life, even if, especially if you pick an example from someone you know, then it's someone you encountered, if it's from your own experience, then it's something that happened to you, that you were doing. And the other interesting feature I'd like to mention about that is that in both cases, they're things that happen over time. You know, so that you can say that it's a first-person science, I would say, it's a first-person knowledge you're developing about yourself, that occurs over the course of, say, of time. It can actually be over large stretches of time. And it can have a retrospective quality. I mean, you can say something like, although I didn't know it at the time, that decision to go to graduate school and not to, say, go work on a farm, so it was a wise decision, at least as far as I'm concerned.
Can we turn up the TV in the background? It's kind of scary.
Mm-hmm. Push that button in the middle.
This one?
Yeah.
But it's actually just setting up by the question that is really very much a question, that it's something that that I've been working on, and I'd love to hear the, say, the opinions of people here, is it's an issue of how do you study the self scientifically, or, you know, attributions you might make about the self, which is to say that you're those wise or foolish. And, of course, it's going to depend on what we mean by self-experience, as you all know. I mean, there are some people for whom consciousness is going to be, you know, in essence, the defining feature of the self. You know, so people that are in the Lockean tradition. Others, like I think of Dan Dennett, in which the self is the center of narrative gravity, as was mentioned by Jack. The other thing might be just simply reflections on, like someone like Charles Taylor, I'm sure he wasn't, perhaps not the first to say this, in which second-order judgments that you have about yourself can be quite critical to really determining, say, you know, what you call strong evaluations that are important for defining the sort of person you are. And then, and I guess what I'm hoping to be able to do in this project I'm going to describe is get some window into these sorts of judgments that people make when you just sort of stop them on the street and, or in this case, interview them for a bit about these issues. Just for a bit of backdrop, there actually is a whole small cottage industry of scientific studies of wisdom. I thought it might be interesting to people to give you some sense of them, and because they actually speak to this issue of objectivity and, say, objectivity about subjectivity. For example, well, there are two classes of theories. There's a distinction that's been made between what are called implicit and explicit theories. And then explicit theories are simply theories that somebody generated about wisdom. What does it mean to be wise? So you can take... you can take somebody like, I'll just take a name like Robert Sternberg, who's a psychologist. He's developed a theory in which balance of competing interests is at the heart of his theory of wisdom. You know, so you can say, you know, whether your interest and other people's interests, your own interests in the short and long term, this is going to be at the heart of it. And basically the idea of this approach is to say, if my theory is correct and I go and interview people, I should find that when they talk about wisdom, they will actually end up, talking about issues that involve balancing various interests. Probably the most elaborate version of that sort of theory is actually one that's been done by Paul Baltes in Germany. And he actually had essentially five... He was building on, a model of expertise from cognitive science. So then basically his theory was that wisdom is an expertise in what he calls the fundamental pragmatics of life. So that the idea of that would be that knowing about people, about getting things done. In essence, he had five criteria. So you have a rich factual knowledge about some particular area, you might say, and then also a procedural knowledge. How would you sort of get things, accomplished in that area? And then three additional criteria: lifespan contextualism, meaning you put it in the context of your own life or the life you're considering. Something about tolerance or accepting that people can have different values, and then awareness and management of uncertainty. So there are the ideas that the way they tried to study this scientifically, though, you'd say, well, okay, so that's the theory. They would give people hypothetical scenarios of this sort. A friend calls you up in the middle of the night and says he's about to commit suicide. What should one say or do under such circumstances? And then you give people this, sentence, and then basically, or this little sort of like hypothetical scenario, and have them sort of talk it out, give various things that they'll immediately obviously pull out of their own experience, or maybe advice they've heard, or something like that. And you can rank that according to these five criteria, as he says. And they try and set it up in such a way in which to establish objectivity is to have different raters who will each be sort of coding this, and then. And presumably, if they agree, at least you'll be able to say that they were in agreement that these criteria were met to this degree or not. It's on a scale of 1 to 7 for each of the criteria. So actually, there's over a dozen studies have been done with this approach, and then they'll try and bring in other moderating variables the age of the person. Does that make a difference? What about certain personality variables? Like, are they, if people know there's what's called the Big Five, Well, I won't necessarily go into that, but one criteria is something like openness to experience can be a personality trait, in which and so it turns out that if you do that, you find that actually age matters up to late adolescence, meaning that people that are older, so you know, little kids don't score as well as older teens. But past that point, when you hit young adulthood, contrary to sort of popular conception or something, it doesn't really influence the sophistication with which you, or the degree of finesse with which you meet these five criteria. You also have, basically, they try to look it into questionnaires about conflict management style, for example. Are you somebody who's very authoritarian? Are you someone who's very passive? Or are you someone who really sort of actively engages in a sort of mutually respectful way with the problem? When, say, it turns out that the people who score high on these wisdom criteria, they have a management style that's much more, of this third sort. So you can find this type of information that they've that's been found. But I guess you see the trouble. One point that can be made about all of these findings in terms of first-person science is that, well, this is really very much about just your conception of the thing. You're not actually talking about it, say, your own experience. So this is, in fact, everything's hypothetical. It's a hypothetical scenario. So this is basically the critique that's been made, and there's an entire other wing of study that have been called, a search for personal wisdom. And interestingly enough, even within this Berlin paradigm, there's Ursula Stödinger, who's tried to adapt this. So she's basically adapted it and said, oh, well, we could have rich factual knowledge, or about the self, though. So in other words, rich self-knowledge. Or you can have some sort of procedural knowledge that's going to be about something that would allow you to flourish or to regulate yourself to cope well, and so on. You can say for the other three, which I won't really go into. But actually, this is only very much work that's still in progress. So they don't actually have any studies of it. I mean, they have a study that's been done, but it hasn't really been written up yet. But it will actually follow exactly in the same style, because the way she's trying to do it is to ask now a situation in which you just say to somebody, imagine that, so how are you as a friend? So, and talk about yourself. I mean, what are some of the examples you have of being a good friend? And can you explain those things? So it's very much, again, a very rational approach to this whole topic. In contradistinction to that entire wing, there's Monica Ardell and her work, in which she's really tried to look at people who are, well, okay, there's a few things to be said about her line of work. So the first thing she's done is actually gone to interview people who have been nominated as wise within a community of people, and then asking them to sort of talk about themselves and their own experiences. So now very much closer to this idea of first-person science. And out of that, trying to draw out certain criteria or certain characteristics that you could make, and she's trying to develop an instrument. So bring to bear a lot of the psychometric literature, people may or may not know, ways of validating items, and you get 190 people, and you do a variety of statistical techniques in order to develop a questionnaire that should be quite good at least picking out of a crowd these people, the people that answered, who were nominated for this process. So she was able to develop such a questionnaire, actually. So, and it has three dimensions to it. One of them is a cognitive dimension, which is to say that you're able to think through, you're able to problem solve well, you're able to give good advice or think clearly about things. The other one is an affective dimension, which is to say someone who's compassionate for others, who's concerning. So the type of question you would be, the type of item would be something like, other people's problems are not my problem. Yeah, so that'd be reverse score. Now, someone who said, on a scale of 1 to 7, it's not my problem, they would score low on this affective dimension, and et cetera, for each of these others. So essentially it's a scale of 49 items. The third dimension is a reflective dimension, something where you're considering your own experience, and basically you try and look at, say, similar to the simulation model theory of mind, try and put yourself in other people's places, try and understand your own experience in its context. So And of course, there's actually people mention Alan Wallace, and he has an entire his theory of mental balance, very much in the same spirit as the Ardelf work. And interestingly enough, he's drawing on, I think, very much on a Buddhist model of wisdom. So he ends up with three very similar dimensions. We have this attentional. The attentional seems very close to what Ardelf meant by reflective. Cognitive and affective also are brought out. And then this cognitive, which is, of course, what you're motivated to do or not do. And so in some ways we might think that's a refinement of her approach. So all of these are various ideas that are put forward about what we should be looking for in a theory of wisdom, or if we were to ask people to give accounts of wisdom. An entirely different approach, which is actually now very much closer to this first-person science, or calling for first-person science, is what are called implicit theories, which is to say simply are way theories. You simply go and ask people, so what is wisdom for you? And then you're able to sort of see whatever it is they generate, and it turns out that if you ask that question, you get things like people will cite proverbs or maxims often, they'll point to specific people, or specific situations, or certain kinds of personality attributes. And so I guess we can say that this is the kind of thing that, literally hundreds of people have been asked about this, and in essence, this is what boils down out of it. And we find cultural differences. So there are also efforts to ask people this. Sometimes the question is just put very broadly, like, what is wisdom? And there again, I think you end up with a very conceptual analysis. But other times you ask people the sort of question that I asked actually earlier. I would say, if you think of a moment in your own life, or someone you know, or some experience you've had, what kind of experience is it? And so actually I thought maybe I would take this moment to see, sort of like check back on what people have been answered in the room. So maybe also pick a number and see if that person is interested in telling us. So I'll just say the number 4, using Russ's numbers. Okay, good. So I guess, the first thing that comes up now is, since you wrote this account in French, right?
Not an account, just the name of a person.
Okay.
And I couldn't find, I'm sorry, I couldn't find any moment where I expect to say what.
Okay.
Me too.
No, that's good. Because I think that actually speaks to, to this entire project.
That moment of awareness.
Right.
Well, it's very Socratic.
Right. So, which person did you, who did you pick as a person?
I have to say...
Well, you don't have to, if you would like to.
It's... A lama.
Okay.
It's called him a lama.
And what was it about that person that you, why did you pick that person? Is there some account, some story you have that you know of them, or did you meet them, something that happened?
No, it's a general impression, a general feeling that the wise person. I can find some moments that I if you want,
I can. No, but some general impression of when you met them, for example.
Yes, when I was with in when he was there.
Mm-hmm. So some emotional connection, perhaps. Or?
Yes.
Hmm.
Some atmosphere.
Hmm.
An atmosphere.
Hmm. Okay. No. So that's actually that's a wonderful account, and it's also, I think, it'll come up. I'll build on that. Maybe I'll ask one other person. I'll say the number 9. Is that you?
Well, with great respect to I was still in a somewhat lightheaded mood after lunch.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably treated the exercise with a bit more levity than perhaps it deserved. Mm-hmm. But I felt a bit ashamed about my choices after. Mm-hmm. I heard what you were going to say. But my choice of the wise person was actually Max. Because I just thought, I just picked a person at random.
It wasn't an element of levity.
I'm sorry, I just a bit of foot and mouth disease. But I genuinely think that we were having this discussion, and I genuinely appreciated Max's wisdom in, you know, just in the specific area of that we were talking about, which is basically what to do with our sort of, you know, continuation of this for next year. I think Max is a pretty wise person. You know.
And how about for you?
And for the second one, well, again, this is where it really is kind of levity. Max said one of the things we've been talking about was a certain grant thing, and how the Arts Council had put some money into the European funding initiative. And I said to Max, and they ended up, you know, the Arts Council ended up funding a whole load of scientific investigations of consciousness. Blah, blah, blah. And Max said, yeah, you got it. You really penetrated through. It's almost as though you were there. And I thought, cool, you know. I wouldn't think of myself as wise, but. This is like you said, Max had just given me that little comment. So it's all, you can tell me it's all in me.
No, I think, well, let's just hold for those couple of examples, and I just wanted to bring them out just to say, actually, in a way that we do see this kind of variety, actually. So the variety being that you can pick a figure like, almost like, it sounds like almost a saintly figure, someone who's really sort of, at least, and also is in, within a tradition of this Lama, but also in the case of Max, and, you know, even if, you're sort of trying to downplay it, but the ability to sort of, like, you know, navigate these sort of, like, very complex situations is something that often comes up, actually, when people are giving accounts of wisdom in people they know. And I could have added a third dimension and asked for historical figures, you know, and then actually often we'll get a very different kind of answer. You know, so then you might go to somebody like Socrates or some historical figure that we don't really have an encounter, but in some ways is historically constructed to be a wise person. But if you're asking about really people that we've encountered even in our own life, they often indicate these very tiny nuggets of, or little tiny incidents in which, as you said in your own example, like, well, I just thought at that moment I really, in this case it's that it was acknowledged as, you know, somebody saying that that was really insightful or something like that. So the basic thing, I guess, I wanted to, maybe I'll just ask a final question about people that were writing in other languages. Did you have any trouble, do you think you would have any trouble translating this term wisdom? So for example, in
Slovenian.
In Slovenian.
No, no. It's a very clear translation. So it's in Slovenian the word is moder, which means blue. Actually, it's like the same word is for blue and for white. No, not blue in emotional sense. Blue as the color. That's in Slovenian. That's not the.
Is there a connection? Right.
Not blue like being moved.
You feel blue, yeah. Is there a connection that we know in the etymology?
I read some, but I forgot about it. I read some theory about why this is the same word, but some.
Is this something to do with maybe the color worn by robes of, you know, priests?
Shamans. Shaman. I don't know. I can check. So it's direct, but otherwise the word "moder" has, I think, that absolutely the same meaning as "wise" in English. But I could find many other examples where this is absolutely not the case. So, but this one is lucky.
Well, that's interesting.
It's interesting that in Croatian it is "moder," whereby "moder" doesn't have this etymological root to modern, which is like blue, and yet they are so similar. Modern and moder, but in Croatian we don't, there is no this etymology. So what's the word connection for, to the blue?
What's the word for blue in Croatian?
Plavo.
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 Plavo
is like plavo. Yeah. And no problem in translation. There is exact like Weisheit or in German.
It's well, that's interesting. So it translates really well.
Yeah. You find languages where they say, "Oh, it's very difficult to translate."
Yeah, actually, I'm going to come to that. Okay. With some of the people we talked to. So with French, did you find that?
Well, it's a good translation, but that, on the other hand, in French, I think there are other connotations. For instance, we say that an enfant is sage, but he just is quiet. Not very much.
You know that the midwife is a good one. It's just as best.
It sounds more like the wise, actually. I mean, the maybe it's close to the English word wise. So,
but isn't Abizé closer to him? Like you can say, well advised, in the sense that he's really insightful or something.
Right. But that might be translated too.
Well, were there other languages than these three, the people? Those are the two.
The German got mentioned. Weise. Same thing in Spain. Yes. Weise and Blau.
Is that something to do with, I don't, you know, express this?
No, that's spelled differently.
Well, yeah, but it goes back to this and
this is. Yes.
This and
the
body.
The roots of this thing.
When, I don't want to guess on it, but it's spelled differently. But it, I mean, you pronounce it differently as well. Ich weiß is like I know.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you want to say about wisdom, so ich bin weise. So I am wise. So it's.
Yes, and then weise. Right?
Does it have anything to do with. Because Avise relates to, is it vise, which means to, is it, to, what is vise, is it foreseen or something?
Yes, and
yeah. So, it, which is that something to do with vision, or oh, vision? So is vision and why, is, oh, vision and wisdom connected? I mean, that's the logic.
I think that my understanding of wisdom and so wise and bias, I think, actually have a share similar root. And I actually did think that the root ultimately went back to knowledge, that it was some kind of knowledge. That so I'm not sure about the other languages. I only know those for the English. But actually, I do have one instance. So this is like a nice introduction to this project that I'm going to describe, which is that, in essence, what we're doing is we're taking this this show on the road, you could say, like we're asking this question to people of different countries around the world, and it's actually part of a big team of people who I'll just mention. In Ukraine, there's Irina Ivanova. In China, there's Rudy Liu. Japan, there's Yasuji Kojima. Representing India, Ram Mahalingam, and then the U.S. is going to be Monica Ardell. And actually, we have somebody from Serbia, Alexander Bokal. And so that's a team, and then many students actually that are, of course, helping. And actually, Toronto is a nice place to be doing this kind of work, because I actually have students that represent all of the major sites that are from that place. So I have, for example, Anton Yuznitsky is from the Ukraine, other people, Emiko Koyama is from Japan. And so we're trying to do essentially a mirror site in Toronto. So speaking in terms of methods, this is important, because as you can see, I guess we're going around, people are going to be asked in their native language to answer these questions. And then, and I have somebody, let's say, who's in China, who's giving an interpretation of what the Chinese people are saying. But then it's nice to have somebody actually that I can talk to, or that also we can send messages back and forth and look at the actual documents that are produced with the tapes, and in order to say, did we understand you correctly? Or we can have, some sort of crosstalk where we can say, we can get the Chinese, Ukrainian, and Japanese accounts, and then have a meeting in Toronto in which we're able to talk about them with people who are able to, to translate on the spot and answer these types of questions. Like, is this really comparable? So this is the sort of thing that we're trying to do. And in essence, it's actually got, it's a mixed method. So it's got two pieces to it. One is an interview of this kind in which we basically just ask people to give an account from your own life, someone you know, your own experience, and then a historical figure. And then we also ask them for a definition. You know, this takes about half an hour. But we've also been trying to like get something that were standardized in America, like the sort of Monica Ardell type of questionnaire, and then translate that. And of course, then the question becomes, will it translate well? You know, I mean, it turns out that if you use her questionnaire in America, you can actually identify people who are score very high and low on this scale. And if you interview those people, you get very different kinds of accounts of their coping, for example. You know, she did a really nice study in which she had people who were in their 80s, all of whom had experienced very difficult things in their lives, but you could see very different coping styles in the people who scored very high. They were much, much more actively, sort of dealing with tragedy, sort of reframing it, but in a way that didn't deny it, but that at the same time allowed them to work through it. Whereas in the low scores, they often had this, it's God's will, there's nothing I can do sort of approach, which is nothing else, a marked contrast. And their sense of well-being also was noticeably different. So we wanted to see whether this would also be true when we go to these other countries. So, that's basically what I wanted to say about that. There's some issues, of course. This is the question. There actually is an issue of translation. So, the Ukrainian group is working in Russian, and it's interesting that there they say the word for wisdom is a mudros, which I think might be quite close. I guess it's also a Slavic language. But at least in the Ukraine, they found that it was not a very commonly used word. I mean, it's a common word. Everyone understands what it means when you say it. But it turns out that they're not comfortable using this in a way of talking about themselves. Just the way, I guess, I tried this analogy out and it seemed to work well, is that if I were to say, think of a moment when you were saintly, most people would go, well, I don't think I'm going to really pick any such moment. You know, I don't think that there are any such moments. You know, there can be saints in history or maybe even some, rare exceptional person that's around, but even people that I know, like, it's not a word that we commonly use. And it seems as though, and we can find this with wisdom, at least in this Ukrainian context, but perhaps not in Serbia or in Slovenia or Croatia. So whereas if you contrast that to China, in China it's quite common that, the elders are wise, and there are lots of examples of people that you can point to. It's quite natural for them to use this. This question doesn't surprise them at all. So I guess I thought I would just I brought along some examples of what people answered in Pakistan. So there it's an Islamic country. Interestingly enough, say that the person who collected the data is Aftab Khan, who's from there. And he was explaining that there are actually different ways. So Hikmat means to have experience or knowledge or observation. Dir'an Dishi, which means have vision and foresight. And then Akal Mandi means higher cognitive faculties, having some sort of higher cognitive ability. But he was saying that in conversation, though, people will use these terms interchangeably. So basically, these are like, if you really go to a dictionary, you'll find that you have these different distinctions that you can make. But as in a general conversation about wisdom, people will talk about a person as wise in this way. And so I guess this is still to be explored further. And here, I'll just hand this out. And this is basically just a preliminary account. So I have a few more of these than I needed, but this is just an example of some of the things that are said. So actually, this study, as it's being passed around, I'll just tell you a bit about it. So here we have 50 people, half men, half women, and we've got five different age groups. So we've got children who are 9 to 11. We've got teens that are 17 to 19. We've got some people that are 25 to 35, then 45 to 55, and 65 and over. So This is, in some sense, a scaled-down version. It's kind of like a pilot run of this bigger project. And so they basically just, we did this interview, and then we had just this one sort of scale in which we just asked them about some fundamental values. Interesting thing you can look at, I'll just point out some things about this that are without going into any big detail, but say if you sort of look through it, you'll notice that if you take a person who's a personal acquaintance, the men will often, even the male children will pick a male figure. The women also sometimes pick male figures, but other times they'll pick women, other women. So you'll often find, let's say, for the boys would be my uncle, it could be my friend, but in this case it was a male friend, my brother. But for the women it's going to be more, my mother, my aunt. But as you get older, so this is in the teens, you start to actually get people who you move out of the family. So you get into, my boss, my professor, my uncle, I guess as it comes back. But you see many more people there. So you can sort of see the scale of which you're operating expands. I guess that's not that surprising, but it is an interesting finding, I guess, in a way. But also that you find that if you look over to the person in history, we see a similar kind of thing, meaning that we often find that it's an Islamic country, so actually many people will pick Muhammad as the wisest person that they can think of in history. And in itself, that's very, very different, I think, than you would find, even if you went to, I'd love to put this to the test, but I think generally in America, if you would ask this question, people wouldn't pick Jesus, even if they're a religious person. And I think even if you were to go to the Deep South, I don't know if they would characterize the figure of Jesus in that way. And yet, for these people, we have both, I guess we have, Akhidi Azam is actually the founder of Pakistan. He comes up several times. And then we also have Muhammad. But if you look for some of the women, we get Hazrat Ali was actually Muhammad's son-in-law. And then we also have one of the wives of Muhammad.
We also have John Dewey.
Yeah, John Dewey came up. It's also
the list. There was, I think in the 2002 election, there was a debate where they asked the presidential candidates who their favorite philosopher was. Mm-hmm. Quite the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think George Bush said to Jesus.
Yeah. I know, I heard that on the news.
They did say Jesus. No, not all of them. George Bush. Yeah.
George Bush said Jesus. Yes.
And I wonder, I heard that and I wasn't sure what to make of that. I wasn't sure. I wonder if that is typical of that population, meaning that if he expected this is the kind of thing that would be, that somebody else would answer if they were from this.
Uh-huh.
I
don't know what philosophy is.
I know, either say he didn't know anything about it or he just thought, I'm going to pick one name that I'm sure will not be. He can only work for me and can never work against me.
I'm pretty
all
right. And he's got his little mantra. He'll be Jesus born
next. So how reliable are these answers as well? Or is it maybe something that in a social setting, if you're asked these questions, these are the answers that you would give, your father, head of the country, something like that?
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, we're asking these... one thing that's interesting to say about this data is even as he was going, he said, elderly women, I definitely can't interview them. My sister will go interview them. There are other people. So there was a social negotiation about even who could interview him, in this context. And of course, these people know that these interviews are coming, back to Canada, and they're not actually going to be broadcast around. So in some sense, I guess we could imagine that they're, they don't have any reason to be secretive. But it is true that they are speaking to another social person who knows them at least, and so it'll make a difference. And that's going to be a problem, I think, with any account of this kind. Like, often we'll guarantee anonymity, but even so, you're still speaking directly to the person as you answer for this part of the questionnaire. There are other parts in which people are just you know, they can be just circling on a form, something, so their answers won't be known, at least, you know, not immediately, and it's supposed to be anonymous. So, but it is actually something that I think works very, very well in all of these. One of the things that we wove into this questionnaire are there are measures of social desirability. So there's one of the standard things you do in a questionnaire is to put in questions like, you know, something like, you know, if I have an item like, I'm never wrong, right? So if you have high social desirability, you'll say, yes, that's true, you know, because you don't want to appear as somebody who could be mistaken. You know, a few items like that, if you sprinkle them through, if people consistently always refuse to, you know, to allow any kind of margin of error or social, you know, embarrassment or something like that, that can be an indicator of that they may have skewed their answers for other items that were, they were looking to find. But that's about the closest that I think we could come to trying to address that problem. Otherwise, I think it's a serious problem. You know, but I can't think of any way really around
it. Actually,
you know,
looking at more closely at the answers they give,
mm-hmm.
the reasons why they choose the people, mm-hmm. at least it sounds quite honest that maybe it's just a society which is more closely knit, so that you actually have a very good relationship with your boss or you know, other people like that, which is something that I guess in the West is not necessarily something that you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
It seems much more personal and, you know, heartfelt.
Mm-hmm.
So when they say, you know, my professor, you know, smiles and everything, so.
No, I think that's an interesting point. Is one thing that, you know, when you look over the, say, the tenor of all of these is, has a certain flavor that is much more socially internet. So that's one of the things that
I mean.
Like if you, and these are very much like, of course, these are very condensed summaries of, you know, like basically this could be a 20-minute interview and we pulled out this part of the, you know, the essence of what they said. But, you know, one person, you know, said like, moments that were wise, this one woman that really struck me, was her son was sick and she had to go to the hospital, and then and basically because her husband was not there, she had to navigate this entire hospital system on her own. So that was one instance. And another instance was her brother was going to spend a lot of money for a certain, you know, sort of like a ceremony, similar to, I guess, a bar mitzvah, but, you know, this kind of like public ceremony where you celebrate achieving a certain age. And some people were very lavish in these, but she convinced them to scale it back and just spend, you know, say a modest amount of money. So because it was really, you know, the ceremony itself was important. So in all these examples, there are things in which she's actually acting, you know, in concert with other people that matter to her in ways that, you know, that are basically for, you know, for their benefit. So that was a very interesting, like, framing. That's not the kind of thing that if you look at it, like, having looked at many of the American answers, North American answers, you don't come up with that answer very, very often. So I guess this is one of the things we're hoping to, like, find out as we really look into this. You know, are there certain things that you can say from the kinds of accounts people give that say something about, you know, maybe the nature of the way they see themselves in relation to others or the tenor of the whole society that may not be, it's similar to your technique in a much sort of more macro scale. I mean, this is, you just say to somebody, just pick an instance, and they'll pick something. But often, at least I would maintain that the types of things that come out say something about that person and also about their social setting that might be surprising that, you know, that if they were just asked to define wisdom, they wouldn't have come up with. You know, they would have just come up with some kind of definition out of a dictionary.
Michelle, I'm curious to know, because we have a sort of culture of celebrity in the UK and in the US, how many people between the ages of 9 and 19 in the wisest person in history, we're putting down things like people like celebrities.
Well, I mean, he's just in the midst of analyzing this, so this is in some ways a snapshot of what we have. So I actually don't have the figures for all the others, but it seems to me that we see, like, if you go along, I mean.
Well, I shouldn't ask how many. What I should really ask is, are there instances where people in that age group are putting down celebrities rather than people
like
who we would consider wise, do they?
Yeah, well,
you mean like Paris Hilton? And,
yeah.
Yeah, people like that, David Beckham or
right.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll be interesting to see if it comes out. You know, out of these ones, we have, let's say, about 6 or something. There's actually none of them. You know, so
yeah.
If I, you know, I guess
What did you want? Just curiosity.
What's that?
Yeah. Can you read?
Oh, sure. Well, the first in wisest person in history, we have Kidi Azam, who's in the founder of Pakistan. Then we have Muhammad.
I was just wondering about the Western contrast.
Oh, the Western contrast.
Yeah.
Actually, we're just putting that together now. So unfortunately, I'm not able to answer that question. Yeah. But it would be very interesting to see whether, in Canada, for example, if maybe we come up with people who are celebrities.
It's curious. Yeah. It's just that... So you're bound to get important cultural differences. Mm-hmm. As you distract, aren't you? Because,
yeah.
Pointed out, so many people said Muhammad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And not only, for a start, it might even be quite dangerous not to put Muhammad.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Given that question, but also bound to say something rather deep.
Presumably, this is confidential.
No, but if you have to speak to somebody, your neighbour, anyone you know, and people. It depends on the actual situation, but I think people are probably wary, but it may go deeper than that insofar as you suspect the very notion of wisdom might be tied so strongly in some cultures to the dominant culture, as opposed to this individual search for what's wise or something that we pursue in the West.
Like, I do have a little bit,
say, it can be really interestingly different.
Like, they aren't young. They aren't so young, but people that in their 20s, we have some pilot work from the Ukraine and from China, and there you see that actually you get both religious figures like Solomon, Jesus, but you also get statesmen like, actually interesting, Stalin, Roosevelt, which is also interesting, and it's there. And then, and what's that? Yeah, in China, they came up with Mao Zedong also. So philosophers and scientists, the specific ones that will be named. So, and there is a slight difference, but no one, there again, nobody came up with, it's just a celebrity figure. I mean, actually, in any of the three sites that we've picked up, but these are now, they're young adults, so they're people that are around in their early 20s as compared to older people. But the interesting thing there is that it is true that people who are older in the Ukraine and China tend to pick statesmen who are, people like Stalin, Mao, who were really active at the time that they were growing up. So whereas the younger people will often pick somebody like, let's say, even Confucius is picked much more by the younger people as a wise person.
Would that be because they feel they can't yet make the judgment on anyone?
Mm.
It might be just a kind of slot.
Mm. Yeah, it's true, part of the, you have to ask, people are asked to ask, to explain why also they pick. So in that sense, it is true that if you say the reason why, so in the case of Mao, it was interesting that the reason was that, this is from one protocol, that he was able to defeat an army of, 2,000 real guns with 300 fake guns. So that at least shows that for this person, he's using the word wisdom in a very sort of tactical way. But within China, that's one of the connotations that you can use, that you're able to sort of like outfox people or outmaneuver them. And then, so I guess that's...
Say, Michel, you asked us a question, the two questions, but you didn't use the word wisest.
Hmm.
You just said an example of something. Example of a wise...
Hmm. Yeah. As opposed to who's wisest,
which is how these are.
Yeah, I think this was an earlier version, and we decided to soften it because that's the thing, is that if you make it say something like that, then you put them in a bind where what they've got to answer is sort of committing you to, and also you might just say, well, I don't know, I've got so many choices that which is interesting, even here. People often, were asked to give one answer, but they would spontaneously give several answers. Mm-hmm. So if you just pick a moment, in the course, because, now we're just doing it as a paper and pencil exercise, but if we were talking, somebody would have, it's much more natural if you would say one thing and then go, oh, well, actually, now that I'm talking, another thing has occurred to me. And so it draws out, and then usually after a bunch of those, you might say, well, which one of those would you pick now? And that's the way we get it. Of all the things you've mentioned, Which do you think is the wisest? And talk a bit about that. So, as opposed to nailing, you're trying to nail them down from the very beginning. Well, I guess maybe I'll just end with a question, which is that, I was very curious what, what we're kind of hoping to do is, as I said, to take these interviews, and now, each one will be in its own language. In some ways, you can imagine that they're very hard to relate to each other as narratives, because you can have very different, totally different contexts within which people, grew up. It's also worth mentioning that part of the backdrop to this is we also asked them to tell about themselves a little. Say, who are you? What's your general, are you married? So we can get a bit of a sense of how to situate these stories, too, because the very first time we tried it, we asked only for the stories of wisdom. You get a very narrow snapshot with no context, of the broader life within which this event takes place. So now we've got, if nothing else, we're going to have some very interesting sort of self accounts of lived experience of people from these different cultures at different ages, and then also this view of wisdom, and these questionnaires. So we're going to be able to at least nominally compare across and see, do they have a similar pattern? And we tried a very modest version of that with one, and we. For example, if you just give a list of attributes, like a wise person for you, is that a person who's intelligent? They'll just say, don't feel like you have to answer. Is it someone who's has a lot of warmth? Is it someone who's a sort of childlike awe and wonder? Someone who's funny, who's humorous? There's a whole list of things like that. It turns out if you give that same list to people in China and the Ukraine, you get quite different portraits of people. So what they consider, so humor actually, it turns out, was relatively well regarded in China for a wise person. In the Ukraine, it was completely not part of the equation, right? I mean, they really didn't think that was at all, say, part of what it meant to be wise.
Paul never makes jokes.
Right, yeah. So I guess I'll just end with that to say that we're basically starting this, and we're hoping to be able to find a way of really getting some rich sort of first-person knowledge out of these accounts, but realizing that actually, I guess if I tie it back to some of the things that were said earlier, and to me it speaks to the same notion of objectivity, the relationship between objectivity and subjectivity, at least in this way, that people are asked the same set of questions, and some, if they answer sincerely, we can say that that's their account. We have, say, 100 of them, so there are all kinds of things that could be considered objective about it, but in other ways, of course, it's subjective in a way that's quite difficult to compare across different languages, different traditions. And then even if you translate a questionnaire, say really you can say, like, it's not clear that you can translate it in a way that remains that it can actually translate, that it means the same thing to somebody who's answering this question in, say, in one context or another. So these all seem like issues that we're grappling with as we try and pull this off. So I'll just stop there. I don't know if people have any other comments or questions. Or
I guess questions about methodology, which I'm thinking to someone I know who did a study of aesthetic development of aesthetic appreciation and show people pictures, I mean hundreds of people, took their interviews and parsed each phrase and actually came up with an understanding through the parsing of what they said of a developmental process. She discerned four stages in that development. And it strikes me that it's kind of suggest that possibility of a developmental understanding of wisdom. That may be not what you're after.
No, absolutely. That's part of what we're trying to do. Yeah. That's why we're asking people at different ages. I mean, the simplest thing for all the sites is to have people who are over 65 and people in their 20s. But in this case, because it was just an opportunity to go to Pakistan, it was quite interesting to me to see what both children have, 10 answered a question like this. And it's it's been found, for example, in the literature about the self, that we take to be a typical sort of life story where you say, oh yeah, as a small child, I always wanted to be something or other. But then this happened. I always wanted to be a great basketball player, and I was on the top teams, but then I broke my leg. And since then, people will do that type of a story. It turns out they'll only do that actually from the time that they're a teenager, like their late teens onward. Before that, they will have just sort of snapshots. So they'll say things like, tell me about yourself. Well, every summer we go to France for vacations, or they'll have specific memories. You can go quite young, actually. And if you go really young, you have to sort of help them build it. So if it's a child of 2.5, you'll say something like, what did we do? You remember yesterday where we went? And they'll say, the zoo, that's right. And what did we see? You have to get them talking. But this sense that, so there's a real sense in which sense of self and self as a story in particular is definitely has a developmental trajectory that's been well documented. And so whether people's accounts of wisdom and the kinds of ways in which they even frame that account is also developmental seems quite plausible that it would be true.
Well,
yeah.
It strikes me that there's a possibility of the difference between men and women.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I think there should be.
No Carol Billings or.
Yeah, I know, that she's done those types of exactly looking at interviews with people and their morality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's one of, that's what I was saying, that if, even just glancing at this, it's interesting to me that there are many occasions in which the women will pick other women, but I don't think there's a single instance in which actually one of the men picked a woman. Except possibly there was one where he picked his mother, one of the teens. So that's actually, if it's true for the others, then that will be already a significant finding about the way people understand wisdom contextually, that they're pointing to these figures, even in their own lives, that are sort of like male figures. I mean, it would say something about social... What?
I picked a woman.
Oh, you did?
Not
oh, good.
In the whole history, but yeah. Men took the son of God.
Yeah. So that might actually be... well, that's actually nice to hear. Maybe it's going to be something that will really be a difference than what we're seeing in Pakistan and in I think it was true also for China, but we only had a few instances. So that is definitely one of the things. What?
The wisest thing I do is when I fix the TV, because that's a real man's job.
Yeah. and that interview was very interesting because that... Say, woman, she picks her father because...
Oh, it was a woman.
Yeah, it was a woman. and that's one of the rare, one of the cases in which she really, her father, she wanted to go, I'll just give you more of the context of the whole interview. She wants to go into the Air Force because her father's in the Air Force. And that's a very rare thing in Pakistan. And her father's in supportive of that, but her mother's against it. And so she really admires her father. And then it turns out, as the interview goes on, that, he takes her to various other places that are more sort of a typical, place where women don't go, and then, that's it, that she fixed the television, all these sort of things where she's, she's basically, picking examples of success in what is often a male realm.
Future prime minister.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You've done the study, but I was just thinking that you ask people to pick something they've done that was wise, and then you ask them to pick a wise person, and then you went back and asked them again, can you think of any other instances that you did that were that were wise? Would you notice some kind of a change?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Because one of the things you notice, especially in places like the Ukraine, in which they're not used to... thinking about themselves in these terms, basically they start with a lot of resistance. And in fact, that's why we start with acquaintances. It seems easier usually in these places because, it's more so, it's more modest. It's much easier to sort of point to somebody that you know and say that about them. But it is true that, that as the conversation goes on, people get, they develop their ideas about what they want to say or what examples they want to choose and why they support those examples. And, part of it is just the limitations that we don't want to exhaust our people as we're talking to them. But I actually had the idea that it would be nice to return and do, a second interview, at a future time, maybe a few months later, and see, is it then the same kinds of things remain. As you said, you know, you had a little bit of time to sit with this, or even you know, say to yourself, "Oh, I don't know if that was really the best answer," or even for that matter, just pick it up again and keep going, whether you would answer in the same way. And that, I think, is an interesting point for these types of first-person methods, because often people are asked to like give an account or some sort of phenomenal report. That's like basically they're called, you know, they're just you know, they're presented with something, especially if it's in an experimental setting, in which they may not be that familiar. They haven't done that sort of task many times before, and so you give an account, but it's not clear that it's as full an account as if you'd been able to have a lot of practice. I guess this was the intuition behind, you know, drawing on people who have a lot of experience, you know, with the meditative practices. Then you have a lot of experience, presumably. But whether even there, if you, you know, the sort of things you're asked to like to recount about them are often things that you're not used to saying, I believe, you know. So it seems like it's a whole other, you know, part of the story, which is, you know, similar to, let's say, you know, these types of tasks almost ask people to become novelists of their own lives or something, right? So suddenly you've got to create a story, you've got to have characters, you've got to have settings, there's a lot of things that you've got to bring in to make it actually an effectively convey even what you might have wanted to say about that story. Or you might end up saying, as Claire said at the beginning, well, I don't know exactly, I just had this very good feeling about this person, and they impressed me, but I don't really know exactly what to say about it that would make it into a story, you know, so that it's just that person left a great impression on me, you know. So, and we get some answers like that, or people that resist the entire question. You know, they'll say, "Well, I don't think there are any such people." I mean, you know, I think that, you know, maybe in storybooks you have accounts of wise people, but really in life, I mean, that's, you know, or, you know, someone else will say, "This struck me as you get older, you accumulate experiences, and you become so that basically everything you do." You know, it becomes wiser, right? So every single, if there's no particular one thing you can pick, it's just you become a sort of person who's now, who's gained in wisdom but over the course of your experience. So part of what we can see from this, at least, while it's not perfect, is you can at least get certain kinds of ways people are framing this and the way they see their experience or their development. But you're right, I think if you were to ask them again, say it'd be interesting to see if they continue to develop that, or if they even change their views.
Michelle, I just wondered, you know, I mean, obviously, because we're here, our sort of buzzword is not what wisdom, but consciousness.
Mm.
Do you see ways in which this similar methodology might be used in consciousness, you know, like in cross-cultural investigation? Mm.
Yeah, I guess what I see is the closest
consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, I see a link in the sense that in some ways you're asking people to give a description of their experience. I mean, their experience, it's cast more broadly in the sense that it's an experience that it's a judgment that they've made, you know, of themselves. But for people that know the metacognitive, say, literature on metacognition, which is, say, literature about how people reflect on their knowledge of their own thoughts or their own activities. There's one view in that in which you had metacognitive experiences were simply feelings you had, or say that, you know, similar to the feeling of knowing, these types of things. So a feeling of being wise, is, to my mind, is a certain kind of feeling of that sort, which of course is something that is going to be a conscious, it's a conscious experience. And I also think that in some sense you could imagine that people, you can see in a developmental sense, you can see that to the extent that you're able to dissociate it from, I guess, just their skill in reporting, you can see a difference in the way people will cast their own experience at different ages. And that, I think, will be at least some reflection of the state of their consciousness, what draws their attention, what sort of distinctions they're making, what sort of things that, you say that you know, that they consider important or unimportant. So I guess that's how I see the link, and I think you should see similar effects if you go cross-culturally. I mean, if you were to say in terms of the types of experiences that are, let's take for example meditative experience, even the same exercise. So, you know, take something like, you know, like a simple mindfulness meditation, breathing exercise. I think that in some sense, if you were to ask people to report on their experience of having done that exercise, I think you might find similar effects. Well, at least you face a similar problem of that the description that you have, if it's in a different language, that language has different possibilities of expressing certain nuances or certain things. And I know that's the closest that I can think. Does that seem?
Well, I was just wondering whether one could even design a questionnaire that would attempt to elicit certain kinds of cross-cultural variations about how consciousness was viewed.
You could imagine maybe certain moments in which you were. Are you thinking of something like, if you ask people to give like a...
Well, you could ask them to say, what is consciousness?
Yeah.
Well, the question would be, most conscious present action.
Well, the trouble is, it's very interesting because consciousness doesn't have the same superlative, honorific conversation as wisdom.
We're investigating conscious experience in a way by investigating wisdom.
I mean, it seems to me, because we're investigating, I guess, people's own sense of themselves, how they say, or themselves in a certain particular state, or at least their ability to make a certain kind of conscious judgment about themselves. But I think that you could actually adapt it. If you wanted to get it as something like what consciousness means, you would have to, I guess you'd have terms in different languages that may not have a perfect overlap. Like even... the French conscience, and as you were saying, you started by distinguishing it from moral conscience, because in French that's very, very important. It's the same term. So you can imagine that it's going to be a similar, like if you were to ask people, think of a moment that in your life when you felt most conscious. Actually, even that seems like a question you can ask somebody, and see what are they going to come up with. I mean, they might find something where they're very lucid, or something where they're they had some insight, something, they might just say, well, I don't know, that's a question I can answer very easily. I don't know what you mean by that. And it would be interesting to see whether you get actually, because I think in some ways you might get a similar type of range of response, because we get all of those types of answers to this question too, right? So,
I'm not sure what you could do with the results from that, though. To what end?
Well, to what end? I guess it's true. I mean,
I think that if it showed, as it looks as though your study is likely to show, that there is enormous cultural variability and specificity, that when people talk about consciousness and the way that we do, we maybe may have a sort of cultural bias because we're talking with an Anglo, a US European context. And we're maybe in other societies.
Think of it as an organization activity like they did with color. So they would ask different cultures, when do you use this word? And we translated it as red, but they tend to use it for orange and a little bit of yellow too.
Yeah.
So then you would have to take that scaling factor into account when talking with them about what the color of something is. So similarly, you'd have to say, people from this culture, when they give a report, say, to Russ or to Claire or somebody, you have to factor that in and say, well, then they said, oh, yes, I was aware of that. You say, oh, well, notice in that culture, they think that happens even when you're X, Y, Z. Yeah. Yeah. Is that what you mean?
Well, that's possible. That's not what I was thinking of. But that's very
interesting. Really, very interesting and very feasible.
Would be that if you told the zombie story as a sort of thing, it's kind of iconic within the consciousness study community, I guess. If you tried to tell that story to different people across the world, you might get very different responses. Or the Mary story,
That would be really fascinating. What do you make of this? Is this even possible? Or if you got them to give an account of such as, does it even make sense as a story?
Maybe other things which are not so much to do with those, almost joke, well, maybe not joke, but the quirky kind of thought experiment things, but things to do with what do you, well, I did just asking people what do they think it is to be conscious or to be experienced. You might have to give a range of words, you know, like Russ, you know, Russ's discussion on how you actually identify what it is you're trying to get people to.
Well, there's
you're running into really deep problems, I think, because if you ask that question to people in our own culture, there's a recent, I've had emails recently by somebody who wants to get all of us together to try and define consciousness, and I have to decide how to reply to this email, you know, which is at first thinking, yeah, good idea, and then backing off, and the you know, within the consciousness studies community, there's no agreement about this. And you really have to kind of study the Mary story before deciding how you're going to go with it. So the only way that I can see that enterprise being kind of interesting is to look at the big tradition. So for example, you could say, well, what does, you know, Western philosophy make of this? You know, what does Buddhism make of this? What do the Hindus make of this? What do the native, you know, natives of Amazonia make of this? And do it that way. But to kind of just sample from, you know, individuals, you know, you'd be left with the same confusion that we've got, I think, in our own culture about that issue.
Well, but this wouldn't be to... Why... Well, I mean, you might just get some, you know, you get a lot of interesting answers. And for example, in some, you know, I would imagine in labor or sociology here, that in Pakistan, you might be very strongly, your consciousness, your people's concept or conception of their own consciousness would be tied perhaps to their idea of a soul, or, you know, what they would be when they die, whereas someone maybe in other cultures, it would be something much more, you know, experiential than to do with me here and now.
Why don't you have the last word? I was just going to say we're kind of far away from Michelle's topics, and we should take a break and then get on with Ron. So, but if you want to have the last word, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say in response to that, I think that this is part of the issue of these types of studies in general, and like one of the reasons why we ask people just to give examples first and then to define it is to avoid this problem of getting people to define something that you're not sure exactly like what they're drawing on, what sense they make of it, and so that even if you disagree with their definition, by just giving the example they have in a certain sense, they're obliged to, you know, say, you know, what's in the back of their mind, let's say, to and so I think in the case of consciousness studies, if you were to have instances, like, for example, there are true accounts of, like, out of the newspaper in Montreal, this guy got up in the middle of the night, went over to his parents-in-law and murdered his father-in-law. And then it turns out that he was sleepwalking, according to all the later accounts. So he was let off. He didn't get any jail time for that, right? Because he was not, account, essentially the account is because he wasn't conscious of, you know, what he was doing, he wasn't aware of it. And so he was let go. If you give that type of story to somebody, I mean, they might go, well, that's crazy. I mean, he's like, I mean, he shot him in cold sight. There's no denying that. You know, so you could get all kinds of different kinds of responses, I think, that would say a lot about what people are implicitly holding to be true. Or they might, how would you explain that? You know, his soul was taken. It was, you know, you might get various, very different types of answers. So I think to the extent that you are able to come up with a set of questions of that kind that let people sort of, explain something that wasn't consciousness per se, but that had a direct bearing on what you would like to, you know, find out about their ideas about consciousness, then it would be like much.
Okay, well, let's stop there.
Okay.
Take a 15-minute break.